Our next speaker is Matthias Kern, who is a professor of international studies at the Master's College and also a student at the Master's Seminary. And this guy has international experience, having been an advisor in Spain and various places around the world. I think you're going to really enjoy hearing him because of his perspective. He was an advisor for the Spanish government on Islam and other things. So I don't know all of these things about you, so why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself here to start off? And so we're happy to have you with us this evening.
Thank you very much for having me. This is a real pleasure for me to be here. I grew up as a preacher's kid in Wisconsin. My parents were immigrants from Germany, so I'm a first-generation American. And I grew up in a very small town, and when I graduated from high school, I joined the Air Force, and they sent me to Germany because I speak fluent German. And when I was in Europe during the Cold War period, this was in the 1980s, I was working in intelligence, and I really enjoyed politics, geopolitics. So when I left the military, I studied Middle Eastern politics at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and then I went to Georgetown University, and I studied international diplomacy in Washington, D.C. When I was in Georgetown, I studied with the Crown Prince of Spain, who, when we graduated, invited me to Madrid to work for the Spanish Prime Minister's office. So I've been in Spain for almost 16 years as an advisor to the Spanish Prime Minister and to military officials in Spain. My salvation story actually is very interesting because although I was a preacher's kid, you know, when 9/11 happened, I immediately knew that it had geopolitical significance, but I also knew it had spiritual significance because my father always preached about the rapture and about the tribulation and about prophecy. And I realized in Spain, it was very difficult for me to find biblical resources in a country like that. And so just by divine providence, I was able to find John MacArthur's radio broadcasts. And little by little, I realized that it wasn't, in fact, saved. And at that December 24th, 2001, I actually came to a saving faith. And the reason why I'm bringing that up is because it was because of my father's preaching and prophecy that really alerted me to the reality of 9/11, the spiritual significance of that event. And so I'm just telling you this because prophecy really is important. And it's a real blessing, and it's really amazing to me. I never expected to be here. I would say there are at least 9 or 10 people in this room that have really impacted me over the last 10 or 15 years as I've grown in my own faith and my own understanding of biblical prophecy, and it's really quite an amazing story how this has come full circle that I can be here to speak to you today. I just wanted to briefly talk about what's going on in the Middle East, sort of put it into a geopolitical perspective, from a secular perspective, but then I'll try to, you know, integrate a little bit of the biblical perspective as well. What's very clear is that global order is disintegrating. The whole world war, the post-World War II order is collapsing. It's a very unique period in human history in which there are major paradigm shifts that are all coming together at the same point in human history that involve economics and politics and religion and culture and society. I believe that the world that will emerge will be different, very different from the, what we see today. The world of the future will be much more conflictual. The world day by day as we see it is becoming increasingly less stable. And America's role in the world is changing very rapidly as well. And I think that as I work through these different changes, I've sort of identified 5 paradigm changing events, and I'll go through these one by one. We'll see that the world is very clearly at a turning point, and I think we're also on a turning point in God's redemptive time plan in history. The worrisome thing about all this is essentially, as has been intimated many times in this conference, is that church is asleep, when in fact the church should be awake. We've all been following what's been going on in the Middle East, the Arab Spring. I won't repeat what's been said already, but I think it's very important to understand the larger picture of what's going on here. Is during the Cold War period, the Middle East was essentially organized by secular dictatorships where Islam had a secondary role, and the Middle East was very divided between competing dictatorships. The significance of the Arab Spring is essentially that this order, this post-World War II order, actually this post-Ottoman Empire order that was established by the British and the French, is collapsing very rapidly. And what's replacing it is essentially radical Islam. And the Middle East is essentially becoming united by radical Sunni Islam. And I think that this is exceedingly significant because this is really the first time that this has occurred in modern history. All of this is really taking place at a time when the United States has completely lost control over the events in the Middle East. The United States has lost the ability to really shape events in the Middle East like it did during the Cold War period. I think the changes in the Middle East cannot be reversed. The changes that are taking place are in the very early stages of a major transformation in the Middle East. And we know we can sort of predict where it's going, but we haven't even really begun to see the beginning of it. I think anti-Americanism and anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism will be the dominant feature of the Middle East of the future. The Middle East of the future will be anarchic, chaotic, and turbulent, and very, very conflictual, very bloody. But the Middle East will remain important in geopolitics because of the West's dependence on oil. I think the true significance of the Arab Spring is that we are in the incipient stages of the rebuilding of the Islamic Caliphate. Now, for most of Middle Eastern history, the Middle East was essentially unified in one Islamic state. When the Ottoman Empire aligned with the Germans in the First World War and the Germans lost, essentially the victorious powers, which would be Britain and France, divided up the Ottoman Empire, and they created this sort of nation-state system that we have in the modern Middle East today. So essentially countries like Syria and Jordan and Iraq and Lebanon, these are fake states. And you could see that by the lines in the sand. Essentially British and French generals sat down together and they just took their rulers out and they said, this country, this part is going to be mine and this part is going to be yours. And since that came into being, there's been an effort, particularly by the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which is formed in the 1920s, to reverse this, because it's viewed that the nation-state system in the Middle East is essentially a European colonial system that really is foreign to the Middle East. And I think that what is significant about the Arab Spring is essentially this unification of the Middle East under Sunni Islam, and really the unification of sort of a caliphate, which I believe will be eventually led by Turkey. Turkey is really the leader behind this, as was pointed out before. The Turks are not ethnically Arabs or Persians. They are Muslims, but they're different ethnicities. So there's a lot of mistrust between these different countries because of the conduct of the Turks during the Ottoman period. And the Turks have been taking very hostile actions towards Israel, for example, to show the Arab countries that they are legitimately anti-Israel and anti-Zionist. I think that the emergence of an Islamic caliphate, which I'm sure will happen, and very possibly in our lifetimes, is a very worrying development. The unification of 1.6 billion Muslims in the Middle East and North Africa and parts of Asia would be very, very powerful actor on the international stage. And the precursor to the Islamic Caliphate is already in place today, and it's called the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. It's a group of 56 Muslim countries, and they are a very, very powerful voting bloc within the United Nations system. And what they are really trying to do is they're trying to use international law to enact international blasphemy legislation. And essentially, what they want to do is create an international law that would make it illegal to criticize Islam. And they've been at this for many years, for at least 15 or so years, but the Obama administration is really the first administration that has actually given some credence to this idea. And this photograph here on the screen is essentially a picture of of a conference that was held in Washington, D.C. last December. It was a two- or three-day closed-door conference in which the Obama administration actually sat down with representatives of the OIC to try to work out some sort of modalities about how to enact some kind of blasphemy legislation. This would be very worrisome. Obviously, it could come to the point where proclaiming Jesus Christ is the only way to salvation would be blasphemy, because that's what it is, according to Islam. I think that's something that is very, very worrisome, and we as a church need to be very aware of this particular issue. The arrival of the Arab Spring in the Middle East has also devastated the Christian communities in the Middle East. Iraq, one of the oldest Christian communities in the Middle East, has been decimated. During Saddam Hussein period, there were 1.4 million Christians in Iraq, and now there are less than 400,000. In Egypt, there's a lot of persecution, firebombings of churches as well. Around 200,000 Christians have left Egypt last year. And what's clear is that if President Assad falls in Syria, and if there's a change of government in Lebanon, that the Christians in Lebanon and Syria will also come under immense persecution. As has been said many times before, the significance of all these changes in the Middle East is very clearly biblical. I think everything is lining up exactly like Scripture says it will, particularly Ezekiel 38 and 39. It just cannot be a coincidence, to my mind, that all of these things are lining up at this particular point in history and at such a rapid pace. 24 months ago, this would have been unthinkable, what has happened just recently. The significance, really, of all of this is that the entire neighborhood for Israel has become exceedingly hostile. And Egypt, which was at least had a cold peace with Israel for many years, the government has taken a very hostile position vis-a-vis the Israeli government. The Israelis do not even have an ambassador in Cairo anymore. The ambassador actually lives in Israel, and he flies into Cairo a couple times a month to take care of business, because the embassy has been destroyed during the revolution in Egypt and hasn't been rebuilt. We've also seen the problems in the Sinai Peninsula. The Sinai Peninsula essentially is a very anarchic place right now. There's a lot of weapon smuggling coming in through the Sudan and through through the Sinai into southern Gaza. What is also has been a problem is the natural gas supplies. Israel receives roughly 40% of its natural gas from Egypt. Those pipelines have been repeatedly blown up in the Sinai Peninsula, and there have even been electricity shortages in Israel recently because of the lack of lack of natural gas. Another major change in the Middle East, especially regarding Israel, has been the change in Turkey. Both Egypt and Turkey are very clearly moving towards becoming Islamist dictatorships. The Turkey-Israeli relationship is in a shambles. They have had a very long-standing defense relationship in which Israel has modernized the Turkish Air Force, and in exchange, the Turkish government has provided drinking water to Israel. Israel recently canceled its part of the defense agreement because it's worried now that the Turkish government will actually use these modernized air force and modernized weaponry against Israel itself in a potential war. It's very clear that Turkey wants to be the leader of the Middle East, has been said before. This particular picture here is a map of some of the gas that's been found in the Mediterranean. Essentially, international law says that anything off your coast, off to 200 nautical miles off the coast, is yours, and anything within that range, if there are borders that are less than 200 miles, that they need to be negotiated. Now, Israel has negotiated with Cyprus to share the natural resources. Essentially, Cyprus is a divided island. The Turks have invaded the north in the 1950s, so the southern part is Greek, member of the European Union. And Turks have actually sent warships to the Middle East to prevent the Israelis from trying to bring some of those natural resources to shore. So that is a very potential conflict in the making there. Clearly, the most important conflict in the Middle East is what's going on in Syria. The conflict in Syria is often referred to as a civil war, but actually it's an epic battle between Sunni and Shia Islam. Now, I do believe that President Assad's days are numbered. He cannot survive. it's clear that he will be gone sooner rather than later. And this will have a major impact on the influence of Iran in the Middle East. This particular map here is referred to as a Shia crescent. The Shia crescent essentially refers to a sphere of Shia Islam, Islamic influence that spreads from Bahrain and some parts of the Gulf Arab states into obviously Iran, now all of southern Iraq, since essentially the United States withdrew its troops from Iraq in December 2011, all the way over to Syria and then obviously to Lebanon. So in one sense, it would be very good for President Assad to leave because it would reduce the influence of Iran. On the other hand, what is coming after Assad will almost certainly be worse than Assad himself. It will be a Sunni Islamist radical government that will be a lot less stable on Israel's northern border. So any way you look at it, I think it's a lose-lose situation for Israel. Now, as mentioned earlier, is that there is some fear that if President Assad is boxed in, that he might lash out with chemical weapons either against Israel or against his own people. What is clear is that that Lebanon is really a tinderbox. And if it is seen that President Assad will fall from power, it would essentially leave the Hezbollah in southern Lebanon without any sort of lifeline. And it could really emerge into a regional war that both President Assad and the Hezbollah folks have really nothing to lose by launching a war. I think, as was mentioned earlier as well, is the Jordan situation. You know, Jordan has a problem with the Muslim Brotherhood, but the whole situation in Jordan really deteriorated about 2 weeks ago when there were riots in the country that actually openly called for the overthrow of President Abdullah. That was really a major change in the Jordanian political risk scenario. And I think that his days are also numbered. Clearly, if President Assad falls, Jordan is next. And the reason why that is significant is because that Jordan has that long eastern border with Israel. And that border, clearly what would follow King Abdullah would be a Muslim Brotherhood-led government because they're the most organized political grouping within the country. And Israel would be exposed on that entire eastern border. And it, to my mind, it would probably even be necessary for Israel to reoccupy, you know, Judea and Samaria and that kind of a scenario. The main challenge really facing the world today is Iran, to my mind, very clearly. This problem is not going to go away. I think this is going to be the main security problem in the world during our lifetimes. And a nuclear Iran changes all assumptions. It's a no-win situation for Israel, because if it tries to preempt Iran, there will clearly be retaliation in the form of terrorism and oil supply risks, and the world will become very, very unstable. If Israel does not preempt and Iran goes nuclear, the world really will never be the same for a number of reasons that I'll just point out right now. I think it's very important to understand that during the Cold War period, the United States and the Soviet Union were considered rational actors. So even though there were 30 or 40,000 nuclear warheads pointed at each other, there was also always a built-in deterrence. It was called mutually assured destruction. It was clear that no one would try to initiate a nuclear war because it would assure your own destruction. Unfortunately, deterrence, mutually assured destruction, doesn't work with a country like Iran, because it's important to understand that in Islam, there is no security of salvation, no guarantee of salvation. You can follow all the rules of Islam, and when you die, it depends on what mood Allah is in on the day that you die, whether or not you're going to go to heaven. The only way that you can get to heaven, according to Islam, is through martyrdom. It's essentially self-salvation, right? And so for the Iranian government, particularly the Shia government in Iran, for them, there would be added incentives to actually use a nuclear weapon against Israel, because even if it would, the consequence would be its own destruction. They would all go to heaven or to paradise, according to their worldview, right? So it's a very, very dangerous situation. I personally believe that Iran will go nuclear next year. My own view is that the Israelis have come to the conclusion that they cannot do this on their own, and the United States and the Europeans are not interested in helping Israel. And I suspect that Iran will go nuclear unless there's a major change of heart on the part of the Obama administration, which, you know, I don't really see happening. I just wanted to point out just a really couple things about Islamic theology, which sort of relevant to some of the things that we've been talking about here, because we've been talking a lot about the Antichrist, and we've been talking a lot about New Age and the Roman Catholic Church and all this stuff. And, you know, the whole purpose of the Islamic Revolution in 1979 was to sort of create this state that was the whole purpose of the Islamic Republic of Iran is essentially to create the conditions in the world for the return of the Mahdi. The Mahdi is essentially the Islamic Antichrist. The theology of the Islamic Republic views the destruction of Israel as a central prophecy and a prerequisite for Judgment Day. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad believes he's been called by Allah to help usher in the Mahdi. He said, "Our revolution's main mission is to pave the way for the reappearance of the 12th Imam, or the Mahdi." The Iranian government has recently published a documentary. It's actually on YouTube. It's been dubbed into English. It's a very, very interesting. It's called "The Coming Is Upon Us," and it's designed essentially to prepare the Iranian public for the coming of the Mahdi. I just want to just briefly talk about this idea of Muslim replacement theology, because we've talked a little about Palestinian revisionism earlier here. Muslim replacement theology is essentially this idea. It's a term that's been coined by Bat Yaor, who's a Jewish scholar. She essentially talks about how the Palestinians and how the Arabs essentially have sought to create their own history essentially by stealing the Old Testament patriarchs, like Adam and Noah and Abraham and Moses. In so doing, they have attempted to artificially absorb the entire story of God's dealings with the Jews as their own personal history. And this is just a quote from Bat Yaor's book. There are many processes of Islamization. One of them is through theology and the adoption of Muslim replacement theology, whereby biblical figures from Adam, Abraham, Moses, down to Mary and Jesus are all considered Muslim prophets. Hence, Israel's history is transferred to the Muslims, Palestinians, and it is easy to see from there the final transition to Islam, where the Jewish Jesus becomes an Arab-Palestinian Muslim prophet. And on this particular picture here, you can see a lot of biblical imagery, the 12 apostles, and you can see the guy over there on the left-hand side. He's the imam, the hidden imam, who's in occultation according to Islamic theology. This particular picture here is the Imam Mahdi when he returns, and the guy on his side is actually Jesus, because Muslim theology teaches that Jesus is actually going to come back and be a prophet for Islam. And I think it's really important for us to just have this in our mind, that the parallels between the Islamic Mahdi and the biblical Antichrist are just incredible. And I just don't think it can be a coincidence. You know, the Imam Mahdi is exactly the representation of the Antichrist in the Bible. The prophet Isa, which they, Muslims, say is Jesus, but has no bearing to the biblical Jesus, is actually the false prophet in the Bible. And the Dajjal, which is essentially the devil, would be the equivalent of Jesus Christ in the Bible. And so the interesting thing here is that it's not just the Iranians, it's not just the Shia Muslims who are waiting for the Mahdi to return, but it's also the Sunnis. There was about 3 or 4 weeks ago, there was a survey down in Turkey, and around 70% of Turks who are Sunnis are also waiting for the Mahdi. Obviously, they're waiting for a different individual. The Shias believe he's a 12th Imam, and the Sunnis believe he's going to be some kind of a religious figure. But the point being is that a lot of these figures look very much like Jesus. And, you know, the Bible teaches us that we are not to make images. And throughout church history, there have been images of Jesus. And I think that the stage has been set for a mass deception for millions and millions of people to believe that the Mahdi will actually be Jesus, or, you know, I just wanted to throw that idea out there because it's very relevant in the Middle East today. And, you know, this is a picture. I was recently in Iran, actually. I was invited to a conference by, actually, the Iranian government invited me there. And they made a mistake on my visa, and instead of giving me 3 days, they gave me a 3-month visa at the embassy in Madrid. So obviously, as soon as I arrived in Tehran, I changed my return flight, and I was able to spend 6 weeks essentially backpacking through the entire country, and I was able to go to a lot of the Shia theological seminaries in Qom and Mashhad, and I was able to travel the entire country. And this particular picture here is of a mosque near Qom, which is where the Ayatollah Khomeini was from, and all these people are waiting for the imam. They're waiting for the return of the Mahdi. Every Tuesday night, there are men and women and children in a picnic atmosphere waiting for the return of the Mahdi. And I just think this is very interesting because we, as Christians, who are waiting or are supposed to be waiting for the real Messiah, are really not waiting for him at all. We're not living in the expectations that the Muslims are waiting for their false Messiah. Just really quickly, the crux of the problem in practical terms with Iran are these cylindrical tubes. They're called centrifuges, and essentially what they do is they spin uranium at supersonic speeds to try to separate the fissile material. And over time, these things are running like 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and there are an estimated 70,000 of these things running all the time now. A lot of these things are built inside mountains, which makes them virtually indestructible. And it's just a question of time. You know, when the Obama administration, when the Israelis talk about the red line is essentially is to what, at what point are enough of these machines spinning for enough time to get enough fissile material. And I believe that will clearly be in 2013. This map here just shows just some of the nuclear sites in Iran. A lot of these things are inside mountains, underground. So I think that it would be very, very difficult for the Israelis to try to do this on their own. And I think that that is the conclusion that the Israeli government has reached. And that's why they have pushed back considerably since October. The significance of an Iranian bomb, apart from the eschatological things that we've been talking about, is really what's called the nuclear domino effect. And very clearly, if Iran goes nuclear, it would become the hegemon in the Middle East, and Saudi Arabia would very, very quickly acquire a bomb, probably from Pakistan or from North Korea, to hedge against the Iranian bomb. And clearly, if Saudi Arabia goes nuclear, the Egyptians will, and if the Egyptians, the Turks will. And I see that this is probably what's going to be happening in the Middle East in the next 10 years or so, that there will be a nuclear domino effect. And the thing is that all of these countries are hostile towards Israel, and there'll be nuclear powers, and you can just see where that whole sort of scenario will lead. One thing is very interesting is that there had been scheduled a conference in Helsinki for December 2012, to create a nuclear weapons free zone in the Middle East. And the idea behind this thinking is that if you can just persuade Israel to give up its nuclear weapons, then Iran wouldn't have any incentive. And so every American administration has rejected this out of hand until the Obama people. And the Obama people were actually planning on attending this with a high-level delegation. And I don't know why they canceled it about two or three days ago, but I suspect that maybe Bill Koenig can figure this out, that the Obama administration must have negotiated something with the Israelis in exchange for a ceasefire, that the Obama people maybe would not attend the conference. But anyway, that issue is probably bound to come up again because the Arabs are very determined to push through this nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. I just wanted to just touch really, really quickly on the Islam issue. Although Islam and Christianity is monotheistic, has been pointed out here, does not follow that Muslims and Christians worship the same deity. The attributes of God in the Bible are completely different in every way from the Allah of the Quran, and yet they cannot be the same deity, and yet many Christians insist that they are, you know? And I just wanted to speak for just a minute about Chrislam. It's this crazy idea that Muslims and Christians worship the same God, and we've mentioned the Rick Warren many times in this conference, and he's one of the proponents of this idea that Christians, and he gave the inauguration address, the prayer for President Obama 4 years ago, in which he actually prayed to Isa, and he used the Most High, which is clearly a reference, an Islamic reference to Allah. And this particular problem is called the Insider Movement. And I really encourage you that if you are in any way supporting missionaries in the Middle East, that you do some investigation into really what are they doing there and are they involved in this insider movement. Because essentially, Christian missionaries, a lot of them from the emerging church, are actually going to Muslim countries, and they are saying that Muslims can embrace Jesus, but they can still be Muslim, okay? That Muslims can continue going to the mosque, they can continue reading the Quran, they can continue to profess the Shahada, and in many cases, they are converted Christians into Islam. This is a very serious problem. They are using the Quran as the determining factor for Muslims regarding the truth about God. They are creating Bible translations that minimize the concept of God the Father and Jesus the Son and the Holy Spirit, because Muslims don't believe that Jesus was the Son of God. The idea is, it's called Messianic Muslims, and the idea that people who follow Jesus can be Muslims. I'm not making it up. It's a very serious problem, you know, and I'll just leave it at that. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the rise of Islam in the West. This has really been my specialty. For most of my career, I've actually been an expert in military and security and nuclear issues, but about 8 or so years ago, there was a Belgian bishop who he wrote an article saying essentially that Christians should just start calling God Allah as a way to build bridges with Muslims. And I wrote an article back at that time just saying, like, who is Allah? And I just looked sort of in a historical and theological and archaeological view, showing that Allah can't be the Yahweh of the Bible. And that particular article really took off, and it got me essentially a lot of contracts to start writing and investigating this whole thing about Islam. And I write two or three times a week about the rise of Islam in the West. It's a very, very worrisome development. You know, during the Cold War, the West was more or less united. Now in the post-war Cold War period, the West is divided. And, you know, Islam is more dangerous than communism ever was. And this is not the time for the West to be divided. But that is the strategy of Islam. It's trying to divide the Europeans from the Americans. And what I just want to show you is just a series of photographs very quickly to just show you the reality of Europe. You know, Europe has abandoned God, and there's a massive spiritual vacuum in Europe, and Islam is filling that at a very, very rapid pace. And I believe that that is our future here in America as well. We see these same trends happening in Australia and in New Zealand and Canada, and it's coming here as well. And I think the church, this Islam, is really going to pose the major challenge to the church in the future, beyond any doubt. I'll just show you this. There are many parts of Europe that are actually called Sharia zones that are no-go zones for non-Muslims. This particular photographs are taken in London. You know, it's unbelievable that you would have that in modern Europe, that there were actually zones where, you know, where the Sharia law is essentially the law of the land. There are 85 Sharia law courts in the United Kingdom today. They essentially have the same standing as British common law. They regularly apply Islamic law to resolve domestic, marital, and business disputes. Britain also is creating a parallel Islamic financial system to fill the growing demand for Sharia-compliant banking products. Britain has emerged really from ground zero for Islamic banking in Europe. This particular map here is of France. There are around 735 no-go zones in France. These are actually parts of France, parts of cities in France that the French government has lost control over that are completely Islamic, and where non-Muslim police and officials dare not tread. This map actually is produced by the French government. They actually have a website that warns people in what parts of the cities you should not tread. This particular map here is of Nantes in Western France. And they have maps like this for every city in France. And it just delineates exactly with the GPS, tells you exactly what blocks and what streets you can't go to, because essentially they're fully Muslim. this whole system of the Islamization of Europe is so far advanced, really, that it can't be reversed, to my mind. This particular picture here is from Malmo in Sweden. This is a no-go zone, and essentially there was a fire in a mosque, and the non-Muslim fire department came in to try to put out the fire, and the Muslims essentially attacked the firefighters with rocks for entering the no-go zone. That is really a true story. Around 25% of this population of this city is Muslim now. With this Muslim immigration in Sweden has been a massive rise in anti-Semitic hate crimes. Hundreds of Jews have left Sweden, believe it or not, in the last year or two. The problem is so widespread that the Los Angeles-based Simon Wiesenthal Center has actually advised Jews to avoid traveling to Sweden altogether. This picture here is of a Muslim group in the UK that has launched a campaign to turn 12 British cities into independent Islamic states. It's called the Islamic Emirates Project. And these sort of emirates would function as autonomous enclaves ruled by Islamic Sharia law and operate entirely outside of British jurisprudence. This particular picture here is of the London Financial District. This is a very, very common sight in cities across Europe on Fridays, is Muslims essentially take over the streets to be praying in the open. I'll just say, although polygamy is illegal in Great Britain, the state effectively recognizes the practice for Muslims. There are around 300,000 Muslims living in polygamous marriages in Great Britain, and many, many of these are actually receiving social welfare benefits from the state. And so you imagine what British taxpayers are paying for homes for people, families of 15 or more people. Just another aside is, for example, in Islamic theology, the bathrooms are not allowed to face Mecca. And so the British government has essentially spent hundreds of millions of British pounds on renovating the bathrooms in British jails and British prisons so that they do not face Mecca. This is a true story. The Olympic Games this summer in London, the British government made a special point of advertising that all of the bathrooms in the Olympic facilities are Sharia compliant. This is a picture in Milano and the Duomo. It's the main cathedral there in the cities. You know, I just might point out, because it was mentioned yesterday by Dr. Wilkinson, you know, a lot of this is self-imposed. It's called the Red-Green Alliance, and it was alluded to a little bit yesterday. But essentially, there is a war against Judeo-Christianity. And a lot of this Muslim immigration is being promoted by socialists who have joined the cause with Muslims in their mutual hatred for Judeo-Christianity, and all in the framework of multiculturalism. You can look it up on the internet. It's called the Red-Green Alliance, and it is very short-sighted, because once the Muslims are able to establish themselves in these countries, obviously the pagan socialists will be the first people on their list. But you can see where this whole thing is going. This is a picture of Bologna in northern Italy. I'll just go through this very quickly. This is Athens. This is in Syntagma Square, the main square in Athens. This is Paris. There are more practicing Muslims in France than there are practicing Roman Catholics. That is a true fact. There are 150 new mosques currently under construction in France. The Roman Catholic Church has built 20 new churches in France over the last decade and has formally closed more than 60. And many of these actually are destined to become mosques. This is a picture of Rome. This is another picture of Rome and the Plaza Venezia. This is a picture of a mega mosque. The mega mosques are really becoming the new cathedrals in Europe. This particular one is in Cologne, and it's being paid for by the government of Turkey. And the objective here is to change the skyline to compete with the famous Cathedral of Cologne, for any of you who have ever been there. This is a mega mosque in Madrid. It's a massive, massive complex that's paid for by the government of Saudi Arabia. This particular picture here is it says lies, but in German it says lies, which really means to read. And it's basically a campaign by Salafists, which is a very radical form of Wahhabi Islam, to distribute a Quran to every single household in Germany. And so wherever you go in German cities on the weekends, you can see stands everywhere, giving out free Qurans. Hamburg, city in northern Germany, last week was the first city in Europe to recognize officially Muslim holidays. So you can see where this is going. You know, what's very interesting is that a lot of this is due to immigration, but a lot of it is also due to conversion. Many, many Europeans are converting to Islam. In Great Britain, for example, I just recently read the demographics that the most common person to most common demographic would be a woman, middle-aged, in her 40s, to convert to Islam. So there is a real spiritual void, and people are grasping at Islam in a really rapid rate. This is in the Netherlands. I'll just go through this very quickly. This particular picture here is of Spain. Essentially, dogs are unclean animals in Islam. And in this particular town near Barcelona, the Muslims went to the mayor and they asked the mayor to outlaw dogs. And the mayor said, no, this is Spain. And so last fall, many, many dozens of dogs were poisoned by Muslims who were not able to get their way through the mayor's office, so they went and took the situation into their own hands. You know, there's also move to in Europe to remove crosses. Now, these particular symbols are from the main football teams and soccer teams in Spain. The first one is from Real Madrid, and you can see the crown of the royal family with the cross on one side, and then it was removed as a way not to offend Muslims. You can see the football club Barcelona wear the cross of St. George. It's a crusader cross, been removed to not offend Muslims. These are true stories. This is football jerseys are also a major problem. In Manchester, for example, the Blue Devils, there's been a major controversy with Muslims who find that particular jersey offensive. The picture here on the left is Inter Milan. The picture on the right is Portugal. This particular picture is of Muslim immigrants in Switzerland don't like the Swiss flag because they're offended by the cross. And they have actually asked the Swiss government to consider creating a new Swiss flag that is more multicultural. These are true stories. I just want to very quickly go through the economic crisis that is taking place in Europe. This particular picture here is from the New York Times, and it sort of encapsulates globalism. The world is very, very integrated economically. And so what happens in Europe is going to affect us here in the United States. There's just no way that we can be immune from that because the Europeans are our main trading partner. And the problem really is in Spain, they cannot pay their debts. And it is a massive country. It's the fourth biggest country in the Eurozone, and it's bigger. It's twice as big as Greece, Portugal, and Ireland combined. There's just not enough money in circulation to bail Spain out. The situation is essentially so grave that, as this picture shows, that if Spain collapses, it's going to, by definition, affect Italy and France and Great Britain because all of these other European countries are holding, Spanish debt. And I just want to show you this picture here. This is the reality. This is Barcelona. The situation, this is the modern welfare state really unraveling in Europe. People are desperate, and they're going through garbage containers to find food. This is a picture of Madrid, of young people just looking for food. I just want to explain really quickly what's going on with these bond markets, because the bond markets is really what the problem here is, and it's like a giant Ponzi scheme. And it's essentially what you do is you sell bonds every week in the United States or every couple weeks in a smaller country like Spain, and you use that money that you raise by selling bonds to pay off old debt. And when nobody wants to buy your bonds because of the risk that, you know, you're not going to be able to pay them back, you go into default because you can't pay back your old debt, you know. And what has happened is essentially is that the European Central Bank has become the buyer of last resort, and what they're doing is they're printing massive amounts of money to buy European debt. So it's essentially they're printing money to make it seem like people still want to buy Spanish bonds. This is a picture of, these are not real dead people, but it's a monument in a bridge in Paris to suicides. There's a massive wave of suicides that are taking place in Europe, in almost every European country, because the people are so desperate. And, you know, they don't have the gospel, and they have no money, and they have no food. And a lot of people are being evicted from their homes because they can't pay their mortgages. And this is really a monumental tragedy. I'm not going to talk about the United States situation other than to say that You know, what was alluded to is there's a lot of debt in the United States as well. The Cato Institute, it's a libertarian think tank in Washington, D.C., has calculated that with all the unfunded liabilities and all the debt and all the new entitlements that are still down the road, that the debt is actually at $136 trillion. And they've calculated that at roughly $450,000 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. So it is clear that this situation in Europe and the United States can't continue. What has been alluded to earlier by Bill Koenig is essentially that the Federal Reserve has been printing a lot of money. It used to be that the Chinese bought U.S. bonds. They stopped buying American bonds in September 2009. And as a way to not spook the markets, the Federal Reserve has been printing massive amounts of money to buy U.S. bonds, essentially. And so it's called euphemistically quantitative easing. You've probably heard of it. And it's just printing a lot of money. And, you know, this is with the third tranche of this right now. The first one, QE1, was $1.75 trillion. The second, QE2, was $600 billion. And now, about 3 months ago, the Federal Reserve announced that it would be printing $40 billion a month open-ended. So there's no end to this. It's just keep printing more money and printing more money to make it seem like we're afloat, but we really are, you know. And one of the reasons why gasoline is so expensive in the United States is because gasoline is priced, oil is priced in U.S. dollars, and there's so much money in circulation that the dollar has really lost on its value. And the Arabs want more money for their oil, right? So can I have just a couple more minutes? Is that okay? Okay, this other trend, you know, we've talked about the Islam in Europe, and we've talked the Iranian nuclear thing, and we've talked about the Middle East. The other thing really is the post-American world order. I think this is very important for us to understand because, you know, President Obama is the first postmodern president in our history, and he's the first president who does not hold to the concept of American exceptionalism. And I think that he is really the product of elite education. You know, I went to an elite school, and a lot of the guys that I actually went to school with are in the Obama administration, in the National Security Council, and I know how, you know, these people think. And I think this is really the future of where America's headed. Schools are very liberal, particularly the elite schools on the East Coast that produce the bureaucrats that run the country. And so I think that, you know, Obama is just really the future of what we're going to have in the idea essentially is, you know, there's a difference between realism and idealism. And realism is you try to see the world as it is. There's a world with evil in it. And we have to deal with that reality. And idealism is the opposite of that. And idealism sees the world as it should be. And these are two very clear schools in international relations theory. And President Obama is clearly of the idealist, school of thought. And this is very dangerous because President Obama believes that we can start reducing our commitments around the world, that we can be unilaterally reducing our nuclear arsenals, and it's leaving the United States in a very, very weak position. This particular picture shows essentially how the world is divided at this point in history geopolitically. You can see that the U.S. military is in every part of the world maintaining a certain degree of order. It's a unipolar system. What is clearly emerging is a multipolar system in which the world will be more organized into regional groupings in which much less American influence abroad. The thing is that bipolarity that we saw during the Cold War was the most stable system in the world. And unipolarity, the one that we're in right now, is a very unstable system because there are many competitors that want to remove American dominance. But the multipolarity is the most unstable because you have a lot of different powers with more or less equal military power, and they're all vying for dominance. And that's really where we're headed. This particular picture shows essentially choke points. There's seven main choke points in the world. And the U.S. Navy is there traditionally since the dawn of the atomic age to maintain a certain degree of order in the world. Clearly, if the United States removes its forces from Asia and from the Middle East, which there is a lot of talk. And very clearly, if there's a collapse of the U.S. dollar or a collapse of the euro, the United States will not be able to field its military the way it has for the last 60 or 70 years. There will be a major, major geopolitical shift. This particular picture just shows oil, the choke points of the oil. The global economy runs on the oil, and up until now, the United States has essentially provided a policing service to maintain those sea lines of communication open. I believe that is about to change. You know, there are a lot of competitors against the United States that would like to see us reduced, and one of them is China. And this particular map shows about how China is having different conflicts in the South China Sea with its neighbors. And the United States has essentially distanced itself from these conflicts, and it's asking our allies to fend for themselves. And that's very dangerous, because to the extent that the United States is not viewed as a reliable ally, all of these are countries are going to sort of draw closer to China. Essentially, these just show some of the competitors of the United States. And I think maybe I'll just leave it at that. You know, I think basically, I just wanted to say one thing really quickly about President Obama. I know a lot of people are disappointed about the re-election of President Obama, but you know, Daniel is very clear that the Lord is sovereign, and he is the one who installs kings and removes kings. And I believe that the Lord has providentially raised President Obama up, because President Obama is necessary to enact many of the geopolitical changes in the world that need to be in place, like during the end times, like the Bible says, you know. So I think that on one hand, we love America and we're disappointed to see where this country is going. But on the other hand, we should be very encouraged, because it's very clear that the Lord has to come again soon, that Israel is in an impossible situation where it's surrounded by enemies, and the United States is withdrawing its support for the United for Israel. Israel is alone in the world, just like the Bible indicates it will be in the end times. And I think that, you know, that's where we're really headed, is to a world where things are going to be very, very complicated for Israel. Islam is going to be the dominant religion, clearly, in Europe. And, you know, I'll just leave it at that, that, you know, the election of President Obama should be, you know, some encouragement to us looking at it from a biblical perspective. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Matthias.